ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, you've got Selena Green here with you again to bring you The Country Hour today. In just a moment, I'm going to take you back to a story we covered yesterday, and that's reports of a backlog of applications for farm firefighting units here in South Australia. We covered this a bit yesterday, but today you'll hear what the CFS has to say about that. And a couple of stories coming up today that touch on the issue of access and rights to farming land for projects like mining and transmission line projects. Well, farmers just over the border in Western Victoria yesterday blocked access to workers who turned up to start work on a transmission project there. And you're going to hear from those in the blockade. Over here in South Australia, farmers whose land has been used for mining reckons it'll never be put back in good enough shape to use again for farming.
The land will never, ever come back. We lost a massive amount of subsoil in one area. That's irreplaceable. I don't know where we're going to find it. So we've lost subsoil, we've lost topsoil.
The question today is can farming land be put back into the same condition it was prior to mining? And maybe you've got some thoughts on this, or maybe even some experience with this as well. My talkback number is 1300 160 222, or you can text me at any time throughout the program on 0467 922. 783. But let's start today with an issue that generated quite a bit of response yesterday on The Country Hour, and that's the registration of farm firefighting units. Now, the CFS has a statewide program to register these units, helping to identify them on the fire ground, but also to provide support and resources. We heard from farmers and the member from Frome, Penny Pratt, yesterday, who spoke in State Parliament about what she's been hearing from farmers about lengthy delays in using the online registration portal. Here's a little bit of what she told me on the program yesterday.
It's not localised just to my area of the Mid-North, but it's widespread. So we've actually had feedback from as far away as the York Peninsula. And it seems to be the case that farmers are reporting a widespread frustration that when they apply for permits for their farm fire units, not only have they been delayed this year, but in fact, farmers are still waiting for them from last year and a few years beyond that. So I think we have to ask questions about what's happening with the processing that is adding to this risk as we embark on the fire season.
MP Penny Pratt speaking on the program yesterday. Well, earlier today, I spoke with the Executive Director of Frontline Operations with the CFS, Chris Howie, and asked him if there's a backlog, and if so, why?
So as recently as this morning, I've checked with the team that processes the farm fire fighting unit registrations, and they don't have any that are outstanding. As a general rule, we will send through processing these things once a week to process the administrative function. We are aware that there's been some issues in terms of people receiving an acknowledgement email, but it's important to understand as soon as they receive the acknowledgement email having completed the online registration process, they are in fact covered by us. And so we know that the process with the stickers is an important part of it, but that's a bit of a process we're still working through to streamline and improve as part of a process overall.
Okay, so those registrations have gone through that people have made, is that correct? But the stickers.
So once they receive a confirmation email, which is just a simple one-page email that talks about the fact that this is in fact confirmed, they are covered by us from that point onwards, and they are registered with us from that point onwards. So it's just then finalising the process of getting the stickers out to them. The email actually advises people to contact their local regional office or their group base to arrange for collection of the stickers. But we're currently working on a system that we will try to send things straight through to people, but that's still a work in progress.
So there are people who are saying, you know, look, I hopped in, I applied 4 years ago, 19 months ago, those sort of delays. Those people are actually covered, even though they may not have received a sticker?
Yeah, so as long as they've received that confirmation email, we understand there may have been some back-end problems in terms of that registration coming through to us. So anyone who's sitting for 19 months, we would anticipate that it obviously hasn't, the process hasn't finalised at our end. But as soon as they receive that confirmation email, which, and the very first line is, this is a confirmation of your registration with the CFS Farm Fire Unit Program. So as soon as they receive that email, they'll register with us. If they, in fact, have not received that confirmation email after they push send, we certainly want them to get back in touch with us, and we will finalise things for them.
Okay, so is it clear then that there are some bugs in the system if people aren't receiving those emails, or it hasn't been clear to them then what the process is if people are expecting then to receive a sticker or not quite sure what that's meant?
Yes, I think it's two separate processes. The first is the actual registration online, and we understand there may have been some anomalies in terms of not getting that automated response back, so therefore it doesn't hit our system. And that's some work we've been doing. As recently this morning, I tested the system myself just to see if I could get a registration confirmation back, which I did, almost instantaneously. So if people haven't received that in due course, as in a very short space of time for the most part, we'd encourage them to come back to us. But my understanding is there aren't any long-term registration applications sitting. And as I said, we do have somebody look at those once a week. And then from a centralised location here at state headquarters, and then we will send that information out to the regions, and then they will follow up with the persons who've registered for sticker collection, etc.
Will you take some of the feedback that you've been hearing from people about the issues they're having and think maybe it needs a bit of a tweak, or it needs to be clearer to people what the process is and what's happening when they go through that portal?
100%. We're certainly aware of the fact that there's been some anomalies over time, and we've just started a process, you know, within the last couple of months that we're hoping isn't too far away, in which case a lot of these things will be streamlined into one system. And instead of things being disseminated to regions, we'll look to probably do that from a central location so that there's one person taking that responsibility for the actual physical sending out of the stickers, noting that these people are registered for 3 years once they've registered with us. And so we're just looking at how we can streamline that system and put some more automated processes in place to make it probably a little bit less person intensive.
We just ask about the, or can I just ask about the process with the stickers? So are the stickers required if I'm, you know, registered my unit, then if I want to take it out and use it on a fire scene or assist at a fire scene, is that sticker required on that vehicle?
So look, it's more of a helpful factor to be able to get people through roadblocks and things easier if that becomes an issue. But they're not physically required to actually undertake the ROS. Once you have received that confirmation email from us, you then you log on to the fact that you're coming onto the fire ground, you are covered. It's really a situation of saying once that email has been received to reflect that you are in fact registered with us, you are covered. And once they log into the system that they're attending a fire, and while operating with our CFS crews, they'll be covered for things like catering, for their welfare, for water supply, insurances and safety arrangements.
Is it easier for them, though, if they, for example, come up against a roadblock, you know, if they've got that sticker, does it then make it easier or more likely for them to be allowed to be passed through and get onto that fire scene, though?
Absolutely. I mean, the worst-case scenario is if the sticker has been delayed, we encourage them to contact their local group base or the region that they are part of. But we also encourage them perhaps to print off the email that they've got acknowledging from us that they are in fact registered as a farm firefighting unit, and that should access them. I mean, we've got approximately 3,000 current registered farm firefighting units across the state, and we've had about 500 new registered for this calendar year. So it's a very significant fleet of people. We understand that we will get some anomalies, particularly when you're talking about that number of people, but it's certainly something we're working to address. But if people haven't received their email confirmation, we ask them to touch base with us again so we can follow that through. And if they haven't received their sticker, we ask them in the first instance to contact the regional base or their group base in the area that they belong, and we will arrange to get that sorted as a matter of urgency.
This hasn't, as you say, you've had lots of new registrations of farm firefighting units. Do you think it's a pretty good percentage of the ones that exist out there that of people have gone through this process? Are you concerned at all that this, you know, may have turned some people off and they're thinking, well, I won't bother to register, I'll just, you know, sort of stick to my farm and my neighbour's farm?
So I think at the end of the day, what we encourage people to do is to register with us for all the reasons I just mentioned about the coverage in terms of, you know, we'll make sure they're fed and watered and their welfare is taken care of, their insurances are covered and safety requirements are met. So we certainly don't want people to basically go on their own. This gives them all the coverages they need. We also encourage them to watch our safety video prior to actually doing that once they've registered with us to make sure that they understand all the procedures and processes that will keep people safe on the fire ground. It also talks about the right type of vehicles for people to actually register with us. So it's realistically about saying, if you haven't got that registration through, just make a quick phone call, touch base with your local group base or regional headquarters, and we will certainly follow that through for you. It's a much safer process. It keeps some coordination from our perspective. And again, once they've logged into the system, we do it. So we certainly discourage people from doing things without registering. And we know that, you know, with the total number of 3,000 registered farm firefighting units and registrations lasting for 3 years, once they've done the process, they shouldn't have to do it. We're also working toward getting a system in place whereby they will actually get a notification from us when their 3 years is about to come up, and we will then remind them to actually, you know, come in and re-register with us as part of the normal process.
Chris, how important are these farm firefighting units to, I guess, the work that your crews, your volunteers and the CFS does, you know, every summer?
Extraordinarily important. There's no questioning the value of these. And it's also been recognised in the QLT review and inquiries following the Cuddly Creek, Yorktown and Kangaroo Island fires. So it's certainly an imperative part of our firefighting operations in our regional centres and regional locations. So absolutely they're an important part of what we do, and we're certainly continuing to try and streamline our processes at our end, acknowledging that there may have been some anomalies along the way, but we're certainly keen to make sure that people are registered with us, and we continue to support them and continue to work with our CFS crews on these things, because they make a significant difference to what we do.
Chris Howie there. He is Executive Director of Frontline Operations with the Country Fire Service. It is 16 minutes past 12.
Gallipoli.
When it comes to understanding war, art is our secret weapon.
Rachel Griffiths presents When the War is Over.
If it's too risky to say, sing it.
Starts tonight on ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You've got Selena Green with you on this Tuesday. Well, is it possible to return former farmland to its former state after years of mining activity? One farmer in the Murray Mallee is not convinced that's possible. Murray Zircon has ceased its mining operations at its Mindari Mineral Sands project in the Murray Mallee, and it plans to rehabilitate that site. But the landowner, he's concerned that it'll no longer be viable for farming. ABC reporter Shannon Pearce has been following this story. She's got a great digital article up on our website today. Shannon, thanks for taking time out of your day to join us.
Thanks so much, Selena.
So firstly, just establish for us this mine. Where is it and what kind of mine is it?
Yeah, so the Murray Zircon mine, they're doing this thing. It's called the Mindari Mineral Sands Project, which has been happening out in Macunda, which is in the Murray Mallee, around about 160 kilometres from Adelaide. So what they're doing is they are looking for mineral sands. So mineral sands they process to separate heavy minerals so that they can be used for things like ceramics, food, pharmaceuticals, electronics, aviation equipment, quite a number of things. And they've chosen this site because it is part of the Murray-Darling Basin area, and it's full of those natural beach sands with minerals like zircon, rutile and ilmenite.
This particular mine, though, they've decided not to continue mining there. What has the company announced?
Yeah, so they've said they will be ceasing their operations at this mine, basically saying that all of their mineral sands resources that they plan to extract and that they were approved to extract have all been taken out of the ground now. But this is a site that has been a bit controversial, and it's been ongoing for quite some time. So it was forced to temporarily stop its operations back in December of 2023 due to environmental breaches of their lease agreement. It wasn't halted for very long, but it was only March of that year that they had returned after about an 8-year hiatus, not using the site. So their mining lease meant that they were able to do that. But it's on the land of a farmer called Kevin Heydrich. He's got a property out at Galga. So it takes up about 2,000 hectares of his 110,000 hectare property. And he's really concerned that whilst the company has said that now that it's ceased operations, it will be rehabilitating the site and revegetating it back to its former state before they began mining, Mr. Heidrick doesn't really feel that that's going to be possible, because he says that they've lost immense amounts of topsoil, which is a really valuable thing for farmers to help make sure that the land is really viable and will grow really, really well.
The land will never, ever come back. Number one, it's 1.5 metres high. And if you've lost so much topsoil, how do you replace topsoil? What they're doing, they're grabbing it from up further and they're doing it behind as they're doing it. But when we get up to the other end, where are we going to find that 10,000 tonne to the hectare of topsoil? And then when they got shut down in December or November 23, we lost a massive amount of subsoil in one area. That's irreplaceable. I don't know where we're going to find it. So we've lost subsoil, we've lost topsoil.
So he's not convinced that the company will be able to rehabilitate it back into its former state. Did the landholders, did they indicate whether they wanted mining on that land in the first place?
So this is something that the Heidrick family has said that they did oppose when it was initially put forward to them. However, they did accept an offer of compensation for the land to be used. But what we've had recently is some changes to the South Australian Mining Act. The mining minister said that they'll now be able to extend mining leases beyond 18 years if they feel it needs to. This might be due to not having the opportunity to use that lease or something like that. However, the mining minister, Tom Koutsantonis, has also said that it's not likely this will often be used and that 18 years is generally enough. But I guess that's some of the concerns for this area, is whilst they have wrapped up this operation, Kevin Heidrick does say that they've got about 4 more leases on their land that they could restart this mining to. So it's hard to know if this will be the very end of it, or if this is just going to be the end of the use of this Macunda site by Murray Zircon.
Well, let's hear a little bit more about what he had to say about those concerns.
Well, it's been going for a long time. I was 39 years of age when I started drilling up the side of the road, and I'm 66 now, and I don't reckon that's fair for anyone to put up with mining hassling you off and on for so long. Oh, well, there's nothing stopping them coming back on another lease, and they won't be doing no more in Macunda because that won't be worth it. But we've got, like I said, another 4 leases there. Whether they come back from, I don't know. I don't think it's viable enough at the moment to do it.
Shannon, what about the rest of the community? Obviously, this is a project that is wrapping up. Does this have any sort of wider impacts, and are there sort of mixed feelings about this in the area?
Yeah, it is quite a small community in this space, but what we've heard from one of the local farmers, Jamie Evans, is that this is going to be a little bit of a double-edged sword, because some of the people in the area will lose their jobs or, be offered redundancies, which is something that Murray Zircon has said it's been doing with some of its staff. But it will also reduce the amount of heavy traffic in the area that he said has had a big impact on their roads.
There's a few locals, and what I call the locals within, 30-40K, I reckon you can count on one hand. Some of them will lose their job or already have, and their hours have been cut back, so it's not great for them. If the mine doesn't go ahead any further, there'll be no leases paid to farmers if that ceases. But on the other hand, you move on to, as a local, there's been a lot of wear and tear on our road network, with all the vehicles coming from camp to site and then from the site to Adelaide with the road trains, which has left us with some pretty deteriorated roads.
So that's Jamie Evans, and we heard earlier there from Kevin Heidrick. So that's some of the thoughts of the locals and the landowner. But what about the company, Shannon? Have they responded to some of these thoughts?
So Murray Zircon did not respond to our questions about how that it was planning to ensure that the property would be rehabilitated. Obviously, that is the main concern of the landowners there, so they haven't given us details on how that would happen. But as the closure was announced, they did provide us with a statement that basically said, you know, they've found everything that they need to find. They will be closing it, and that there will be some redundancies offered to eligible employees, and that they'll be trying to use as many SA-based employees as possible during the decommissioning process of the site. And they will be sort of still looking through the Murray Mallee region to see if there's any other possible places for mineral sands extraction.
Well, certainly a story I think that would have wide implications and interest across the farming sector. So if people want to read more, Shannon, you've done a great online story and people can find that on the ABC Rural website right now. So we encourage people to go and have a read. But thanks for coming on and summarising it for us for the Country Hour today.
Thanks so much, Selena.
That's our ABC Riverland reporter, Shannon Pearce. And you can read more about this story right now if you head to abc.net.au/rural. It is almost 25 minutes past 12.
The Assembly.
What would your dying wish be?
Endgame with Tony Armstrong, Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty, and I Was Actually There.
The smoke itself was igniting.
All these and more. Always free, always compelling. ABC iView.
Selena Green bringing you the Country Hour today. Let's head to the Weather Bureau now. Our senior forecaster at the Bureau, Mark Analak. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon, Selena. How are you going?
Very good. What's the headline with the new weather today?
What's the headline? Cloud clearing, I guess. Look, we've got fairly clear sky. We had quite a bit of cloud about agricultural areas this morning, and it was quite low in places as well. But this morning we have seen that cloud contract back to coastal parts, and really we're just seeing that cloud hovering around maybe the lower air peninsula and maybe those coastal districts. Pushing up into the upper southeast, but anything north of sort of the southern agricultural areas is pretty clear at the moment, and we're starting to see some temperatures rising across the state. The WeatherWatch radar still showing some light shower activity from that cloud, but mostly confined to maybe sort of the southern coastal fringes, but not much in it at all. So don't expect too much in the way of rainfall. It should be mostly fine today. Although temperatures are still below average for this time of year, and we'll maintain those sort of cooler conditions for the next couple of days. Currently, the synoptic pattern has a high pressure ridge pushing in over the top of our state, and over the next couple of days, we'll have that high pressure ridge gradually moving southeastwards. And as it does, we'll see the cloud continue to clear, the showers clearing, and we'll see some sunnier skies across our state. Over the coming days. Eventually, that ridge of high pressure will sort of hover over Tasmania by the end of Friday, and as such, the winds will turn a bit more southeasterly and, again, maintaining those below-average temperatures for the state. It's not really until the weekend that the winds start to turn northerly. There's a trough of low pressure that's expected to cross into far western parts of the state on Friday, bringing with it some showers and thunderstorms for the far western parts of the state. And over the weekend, those showers and thunderstorms will slowly make their way eastwards towards central districts, or maybe on Saturday, and then sort of hover over the state for Sunday. So it does take some time for that trough to drift across. In terms of rainfall amounts, we're not expecting a huge amount really for the rest of the week, but generally speaking, we might see maybe 2 to 5 millimetres about the southern parts of the state, the southern coastal fringes, and then across the northwest pastoral district and far western parts with those showers and thunderstorms moving in later in the week, we could see falls of 5 to 15 millimetres, possibly 15 to 30 millimetres with thunderstorms closer to the weekend. So a fairly dryish week ahead, but we're not really seeing any of those really warm temperatures just yet, Selena.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Mark Analak there, our senior forecaster today at the Weather Bureau. So let's look at the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow, which is Wednesday. The upper western district, sunny with southeast to southwesterly winds, 15 to 20 k's an hour, turning northwest to northeasterlies in the morning before turning northwest to southwesterlies in the middle of the day. Overnight temperatures will fall between 13 and 17 degrees. During the day, they should reach somewhere in the mid-30s. For the lower western district, a sunny day forecast also with southerly winds, 15 to 20 k's an hour. They'll turn west to southwesterly, 15 to 25 k's an hour during the morning, and then they'll tend south to southwesterly in the late evening. Overnight temperatures in the lower western district, they should be somewhere between 11 and 14 degrees, and the forecast for daytime temperatures is to reach the low to mid 30s. It is 29 minutes past 12.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years in 2025.
G'day, my name's Lachlan. I'm from a farm at Rudale. And a big happy birthday to the Country Hour.
G'day, everyone. My name's William. I'm from a farm at Rudale. And I want to say a big happy birthday to the Country Hour.
80 years of the Country Hour.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Great to have your company on this Tuesday with you right through until 1 o'clock. Well, what to do with the problem of feral deer? Not sure whether you're seeing many of them in your patch at the moment, but according to the Invasive Species Council, it's a $14 million question. Well, that's the price tag that they've put on the job of eradicating feral deer here in South Australia. They say it's not going to work if it keeps getting funded piecemeal. You'll hear from them and also from a local project that has been funded to deal with feral deer in one part of South Australia. That's coming soon. Also, some great and exciting news for Fat Farmers, a great South Australian organisation. Also, we'll talk about access to farming land for mining, transmission lines, renewable projects, that sort of thing. It is certainly a very hot topic right now.
Access denied! Access denied! Access denied! Access denied!
That was the scene at a couple of farms over in Western Victoria yesterday when staff turned up to start work on a transmission line project there. You'll hear more about that story. As a landholder right now, do you feel like, well, is the balance just right, or do you feel like the scales of rights are tipped in or against your favour? Let me know on my talkback number. It's 1300 160 222, or you can text me on 0467 922783. First, we need to get a news headlines update with Isabella Carboni. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Making news in South Australia, some of the state's lowest paid public sector workers have secured a deal with the South Australian government for better pay and conditions after 8 months of negotiations. About 6,800 workers, including those in aged care, disability and early childhood education, are covered by the agreement, which includes a significant wage boost and increases to Sunday penalty rates. The agreement will now be lodged with the South Australian Employment Tribunal for approval. SA's Education Minister says questions need to be asked about how children's play sand products that may contain asbestos were allowed to be imported. More than 300 sites have contacted the Education Department either to seek further advice or to report the recalled sand products. Two Catholic schools have also closed to allow for deep cleaning. And the updated edition of a book about the Tantanula tiger says it's possible the creature was shot by the wife of the man normally attributed as killing it. Tom Donovan was fated for killing the tiger in 1895, but in the third edition of Neville Bonney's book, The Tantanula Tiger, he says Jess Donovan may have shot it instead. Mr. Bonney says old people have told him Mr. Donovan was so inaccurate a shot that he couldn't hit a wool bale in a wool shed. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Isabella. Isabella Carboni there with those headlines. 28 minutes to one. Well, let's just head over the border into Western Victoria, where yesterday at two farms, groups of more than 50 farmers blocked access to VicGrid staff in the state government agency's first attempt to use compulsory access powers. Angus Verley reports.
Access denied! Access denied! Access denied! Access denied!
That was the sound greeting two VicGrid employees yesterday afternoon when they arrived at a farm east of Witchyproof in an attempt to force access. There were similar scenes on a property at Greens Creek near Stawell. Those employees were there to do environmental surveys for the deeply controversial VNI West transmission line project. But those surveys didn't go ahead. The group of farmers stood behind a locked gate in front of a wall of hay bales and made their views clear. Among them was farm owner Greg Roberts, who read a short statement to VicGrid staff.
I do not consent entry to this land today.
Okay.
Would you like me to repeat it?
Oh, I think I've got that loud and clear, yeah. Okay, thank you.
He says the message has been sent loud and clear.
Well, today we had information from TCV, which is now VicGrid, that they were coming to compulsorily access our land for survey purposes. We'd had the paperwork coming in recent weeks, and we received our 48-hour notice to say that they were coming. We don't want this project, and we think that the urgent need for the environmental work lacks credibility. It's a desperate act because they've got time constraints. What next step is after the day, we don't know, but I'm really very, very grateful for everyone that came. And there'll be another day, I assume, in the future, and we'll have to deal with that at the time. And there was no need for the police to intervene, because all of the wonderful country and town people, and some people travelled a long distance, they all came here to be peaceful. I'm absolutely clear that they got the message, because it was very concise.
And where to from here?
Well, only time will tell, Angus. I dare say they'll try again. Whether it is at this access gateway, time will only tell. But I think we made it perfectly clear that they're not welcome.
And at the end of the day, Greg, what actually happens? Because they've got these powers, and they've got these legal rights to get onto your land. So what happens at the end of the day?
Well, we've been told that they've got the right to start issuing fines, and if you disobey an access order, then there is a process where they can hand you a summons and take you to court. Now, that's all the threatening things that have been waved over our head, and we'll just have to see how things pan out.
Are people going to get arrested, go to jail?
Well, it's quite possible. If they keep crushing rural people and keep harassing them with these claims for urgent access to our farms, then people will not accept it. Time will tell, that's all I can say.
Under strengthened compulsory access powers recently enacted in Spring Street, VicGrid could seek court orders to gain access to private property. Those court orders would permit the use of reasonable force. VicGrid did not say what its next steps would be, but in a statement, Chief Executive Alistair Parker reiterated the preference for voluntary access agreements. But with the expected completion date for VNI West already pushed back 2 years to the end of 2030, it seems likely many more events like what happened yesterday are still to come.
Angus Verley with that report, and you can read Angus's report from the protest at abc.net.au/rural. Well, let's hear now from the Federal Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins. Warwick Long asked the Minister if anything can be done to better manage the transition to renewables and the use of farming land for projects that are being rolled out across Australia as we speak. And this all, of course, comes after the recent move by the Federal Nationals and the Liberals to walk away from net zero targets.
Yeah, and we've had a chat on your program before about those land use tensions and the fact that they have been there for a long time, Warwick. We've also had a chat before that, we do think that the consultation can always be improved and done better. I mean, certainly a lot of farmers are benefiting and have a lot of renewable projects on their land, and they're diversifying their income and they're getting the benefit from it. But also lowering emissions more broadly across on farm is actually helping farmers with their own productivity and their own bottom line. I mean, some of the modelling that ABARES in my department have done has shown that, climate change is impacting farm profits, but if we actually reduce our emissions, we can improve productivity and improve returns for farmers. So we needn't lose sight of that, and that's the story that we're telling, and we're in Victoria today talking to farmers on the ground about it.
What do you say to communities that are angry about some of these renewable developments in their areas, about that transition that they're involved in?
Well, obviously we appointed the transmission commissioner, the infrastructure commissioner, which is the former CEO of the NFF, to work with local communities and to do better consultation, particularly with the energy companies. As I've said, certainly that consultation can always be improved. What I would say more broadly is the vast majority of Australian farmers and indeed Australians support net zero. I would also say that, it is the cheapest form of energy, new energy. And frankly, everybody, the CSIRO modelling, everybody says it's the cheapest form of new energy. energy, and that's what we need to be investing in.
And your energy commissioner says there needs to be more watertight rules around rehabilitating farmland, particularly as programs become to the end of their life. Is that something you want the government to look at?
Well, we're also working, obviously, with farmers and people on land about improving biodiversity and what role the Australian Carbon Credit Units, or ACCUs, have in terms of biodiversity as well. So we're also doing that work as well.
That's the Federal Ag Minister, Julie Collins, there speaking with Warwick Long. A couple of texts that have come in, two separate texts from two separate numbers, but they say pretty much the same thing. First one reads, put the turbines and transmission towers in the cities where the government voters live and listen to the protests. And the second text says, how about putting these so-called renewables next to the city where most of the power is used? No need for these power lines then. It's 21 minutes to one.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
With Selena Green, let's go to some exciting news today for fat farmers. That's the South Australian Grown Initiative that's spread right across the state now, with a heap of groups popped up across regional South Australia, but also across state borders too. Well, fat farmers will soon be joining forces with another group that has some similar values and shared passions for keeping farmers healthy. And that's Active Farmers, who work more in the East Coast. They'll be sharing resources and ideas. But don't worry, fat farmers will still be known as fat farmers. And as they've also announced today, a new health hub trailer that'll be coming very soon. The farmer and founder of Fat Farmers, Ben Wundersitz, is speaking here with Brooke Neindorf.
We're both very similar organisations, both been running for around 10 years, and I think Fat Farmers now has about 40 fitness groups, mainly in South Australia and Victoria. And Active Farmers, who was started by Ginny Stevens, they are very strong in the eastern states, and they've also got Boyd Ray in WA. So they're very strong in WA. So it really gives us a good spread all over Australia.
Why was the need for this this connection?
Oh, well, I think we've been chatting a while, and look, a lot of non-for-profit sort of rural health organisations, I suppose, start with passionate people, and you just you see a need and you do it. But I think at day's end, there's only so much sponsorship, there's only so much funding out there. And so I think to rationalise and join together and, you know, and cut down some of those admin costs, it just made perfect sense. So we've probably been chatting with Ginny and her board for a little while, and eventually, yeah, we decided to put it all together. And, yeah, and initially we'll certainly run, you know, nothing will really change for fat farmers and nothing will change for active farmers, and then we'll see what happens into the future.
So you'll still keep that fat farmers branding?
Yeah, the fat farmers branding will stay, absolutely, and I suppose, and the integration will come in with I suppose, the Fat Farmers Rural Health Initiative overseeing both organisations.
You mentioned just that connection and working together more. What can you see with that happening into the future?
Well, I suppose at the moment, I think Boyd will be really good, and Michael, who's our community engagement person. So I think that just gives us a good spread. Active Farmers have got some great software modelling, and their model's slightly different to us. They've probably done a lot in very, very small communities. So they've certainly got some great resources for those really, you know, that are led by a community member. Whereas perhaps the Fat Farmers model is probably more trying to use existing fitness providers where we can find them. So I think a lot of their systems will help us out, and vice versa. And we're really lucky to have passionate people on the board, and Richard Sheppey, who's just stepped up as our CEO, will probably, you know, he'll be responsible for running the whole organisation. So I think overall it's a more sustainable model, yeah, and our plan is to sort of scale this to from what is now 80 fitness groups to a couple of hundred in the next sort of couple of years.
I was going to ask, is that this going to help with getting even more fat farmer groups up and running in other smaller communities?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, and it gives us a stronger voice with industry partners, and it gives us a stronger voice with government where we see a role. And, you know, and so I think that'll only better resources to move forward.
And I guess those resources, well, not sort of probably competing with each other with a similar initiative.
Well, that's right. And I think we see it a lot in, you know, and without picking out different organisations, you sort of start something, but at the end of the day, you are chasing the same and, you know, the same funding and for us now, it'll just be a lot more efficient. We got a small amount of SA government funding, so we're looking to roll out more groups, particularly in the areas that have been affected by drought. And the other announcement for today, which has probably been a bit of my passion project over the last 4 or 5 years, is we've secured this health hub medical trailer, and that's really exciting. And I suppose I've been seeing the Breast Screen SA bus roll into, you know, rural towns and just through listening to friends at the gym, you know, hearing of all the outcomes. And then I think I saw the Rabobank truck at the field days, and which was sort of used as a bit of a social hub. So we've secured this 48-metre medical trailer with a couple of operating theatres or surgeries in it. And so we're about to launch that at Jamestown. I think it's the weekend of the 7th of December. And so basically what we'll be doing is we'll be doing rural health checks, focusing on skin cancer in one of the surgeries, and just doing all the checks you can for skin cancer. And in the other surgery, taking bloods. And there's some great new technology around testing bloods and just testing for cholesterol, diabetes, PSA for prostate cancer for blokes. And the plan is to really run this right through the field day circuit, initially sort of through SA and Victoria, but eventually, run it Australia-wide, doing industry events, field days, and obviously visiting the towns where we have fat farmers and active farmers groups. So, I'm really excited.
How important is it to have something like that in, to be able to come to a rural community?
Oh, well, I think it's great. And I suppose for me, I lost my grandfather from prostate cancer, and I lost my dad with prostate cancer this year. And, you know, and just early diagnosis, whatever it is. And we seem to somehow, with our cringeworthy name, we seem to be able to get rural people to do what they wouldn't have otherwise have done. And so hopefully if we can say, look, come to a field day event, we'll run you through the drafting gate as it is, and we'll send you out the other end with a health report, and it'll pretty much give you everything you need. And our plan is to link in with local GPs, so there's a sort of a local connection to get follow-up. And we'll be there again next year. So that's the plan. Huge task, but we're certainly the trailer's getting all fitted up now, ready for Jamestown. And probably the only thing we are looking for is just more partners to get on board, because it's a very expensive thing we're doing, and we're a pretty efficient crew, and we'll make it happen. But that's certainly something we need going forward.
That's farmer and fat farmers founder Ben Wundersitz there speaking with Brooke Neindorf. And I know he's been very excited about this trailer announcement for some time. I can't wait to see it. Hopefully we'll be able to get into it at one of the field days in the coming year, and maybe give you a bit of a audio tour of it. But look for it at your next field day after it gets launched next month, and get in there and get your checks done. It's 13 minutes to one.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Let's talk a bit about feral deer. We're in the Clare Valley. On-the-ground eradication programs to cull feral deer are likely to begin early next year. That's thanks to a cash injection from the federal and state governments. A recent $2.1 million funding announcement will be used to target both feral deer in the state's mid-north and African lovegrass in the Limestone Coast Hills and Fluorio. $1 million of that funding has been allocated specifically for the deer eradication program. Perza's biosecurity officer, Miles Taran, says the peri-urban setting of the Clare makes it difficult to do aerial culling.
Yeah, so the problem with managing deer in that area, particularly around the township, it's a very complex sort of peri-urban environment. You know, it's more like the Adelaide Hills than a lot of other places in that mid-north region. There's lots of small land holdings, densely packed roads, houses, vineyards, infrastructure, all that kind of thing, which means that where normally we would use aerial culling, that's our primary control tool for controlling feral deer in sort of agricultural and rural and native vegetation sort of settings. But it really can't be used in those densely packed areas around the township, which is where the biggest number of deer are in the whole northern New York region. So we've got to use other control tools and specialist contractors, ground shooters with your thermal optics and sound moderators or thermal drones and all that kind of stuff. It's a much more specialist kind of an operation to get deer out of an area like that.
So I guess, yeah, because you're on the ground, you're on foot, you aren't able to cover as large of an area when you do those targeted shoots?
Yeah, that's right. And we're not talking about a really large area. That's one of the good things about the deer in the Clare Valley. There are a lot of deer. You know, we're talking thousands of deer here causing really big impacts, but it's a very sort of concentrated population, really, to those sorts of the hills around Clare, immediately around Clare, and sort of the bits with native vegetation left, because deer really like to have some scrub or some cover to camp out in during the day. So it's a large area, but not as the crow flies, but it is, you know, it's rugged and inaccessible, so you're going to need contractors who can, you know, be going in and out of steep terrain and scrub and hard to work areas. It's important to note that, yeah, the impacts of deer in that area have been some of the most keenly felt anywhere in the state, and you know, I could show you photos from back in the drought in 2018 of grape growers in that Clare Valley area where they've had just rows and rows and rows of their vines completely stripped back to the canes by deer who can, you know, come in, and a big group of deer overnight can do tens of thousands of dollars of production losses to a single vineyard. And you've got you know, grape growers just pulling their hair out when the deer are doing that kind of damage, particularly in drought conditions when there's not a lot of you know, green feed or moisture around for the deer. They know where the good feed is. So the landholders in Clare are really cheering about this program.
When will this funding start to trickle into the ramp up of that targeted shooting and eradication program? When are we going to start seeing some more, I guess, boots on the ground?
Yeah, look, good question. So we actually, this project actually kicked off in August of this year, working in collaboration with the Northern and New York Landscape Board. So this is sort of one of the first milestones of the project, which has been announced now. We did a couple of weeks of thermal assisted aerial culling, which is sort of the gold standard for humane deer control at the moment in Australia. We removed 623 feral deer over that couple of weeks, over about 30,000 hectares with 55 different landholders on board. So huge participation from the community. Now that that's out of the way, we're going to be ramping up an intensive ground shooting program, which is going to get into those trickier sort of right into the peri-urban areas around Clare.
And when will that be taking place?
Yeah, so we've got the request for quotes out now with contractors, including some local contractors. We're just working through the kind of the back end, I suppose, of how those how that procurement's going to go and the work's going to go. But I'll anticipate we'll have very intensive ground shooting happening probably from early next year, and there'll be a lot of that, and it'll be very high profile, I'm sure.
That is Miles Haran there. He's a biosecurity officer with PIRZA. He was speak there to Arj Gunnarsson. Well, the Invasive Species Council has welcomed this new funding for deer management here in South Australia, but it continues to argue for more and more urgent funding to finish the job. Jack Gough is the Invasive Species Council CEO. Jack, welcome back to the Country Hour.
Happy to chat.
So this is $1 million. It's a localised project to the Clare Valley. When you look at a project like this, how significant is it in the overall plan or picture of trying to eradicate feral deer here in South Australia?
Look, we know South Australia really is leading the nation when it comes to ambition on feral deer, and that's a combination of being in the position where deer eradication is still possible and also having, I'd say, both sides of the of politics in SA committed to doing something ambitious about getting rid of what is one of the greatest spreading scourges for our environment, agriculture and road users. So this is really important. We know that the South Australian Department of Primary Industries has put together a really good plan for how to get those numbers down. And as often happens with government, you know, getting that plan turned into reality depends on funding. So getting a bit more funding here, that's really important. But at the moment, that 11-year eradication plan, which requires about $14 million to be funded, is still only about halfway funded. So doing it piecemeal with bits and pieces is not the ideal way to get it done, but I'm certainly pleased that we're getting some more funding into this program.
And I think you've used the exact wording I was going to describe it as, piecemeal. I mean, is this the best way to approach an eradication plan if you want it to succeed?
Look, if you want to deal with feral animals, the best way to do it is do it once, do it properly, fully fund it, go hard, and also use those opportunities when things like droughts give you a bit of a helping hand. We've got the commitment there, the bipartisanship on that. There's clearly good regulations in South Australia that mean that getting on top of the numbers is possible, and forcing landholders who might be otherwise reluctant to participate is occurring. So we've got all the conditions in place, but as you say, just having these bits and pieces of funding is not the way to do it. I know that the Ag Minister, Claire Scriven, has been advocating really strongly, and Susan Close, when she was previously the Environment Minister, was an absolute champion on this issue. I haven't engaged yet with the new Environment Minister, so I can't talk to that, but I can say the commitment is there, but we need the full funding and we need the federal government to step up. I've been meeting with the federal Ag Minister, Julie Collins, the federal Environment Minister, Murray Watt, and saying this needs to be a national priority because it's nationally significant. There aren't many opportunities to absolutely eradicate feral deer and make sure they're a problem that doesn't come back. South Australia is leading the way, but it needs that full funding. The state government, the local landscape boards, even the Livestock South Australia have all put money in. We're still getting dribs and drabs from the federal government, and that needs to change.
$14 million, that's the price tag for the full plan, essentially. And, you know, pardon the pun, but if you're looking at bang for your buck, how do you sell that as a worthwhile investment, $14 million versus the cost of leaving deer and not dealing with the problem?
Well, unfortunately, feral deer are a bit like rabbits in terms of their ability to spread quickly, breed quickly, get into new areas and cause enormous environmental damage. On top of that, infrastructure damage and grazing pressure on farms. But we know the other thing, and people in Sydney and Melbourne can tell you all about it, and you don't want people in Adelaide getting upset about this, which will happen. The crashes that they cause on the road are also enormous. So we know that the South Australian government did some independent analysis looking at a business as usual case for managing feral deer versus putting in that full $14 million. And they found the net benefit to the community would be $525 million over a 10-year period. So a $500 million net benefit over 10 years. And of course, remember, once you've got rid of them, they're gone forever, so you're not having to deal with that permanent impact of feral deer. And I can tell you from looking at the east coast of Australia, when feral deer get out of control, there really is no going back. And if you look at the Gippsland region in Victoria, the southeast of New South Wales, forever they are going to be having to manage a feral deer plague, which is enormous cost to agriculture, environment and road users.
That's one thing for South Australia to try and eradicate its deer, but what about other states? And I'm thinking about, you know, a close neighbour, Victoria. I mean, are those states, are they similarly, I mean, have they just thrown their hands up? You know, because, you know, deer, obviously, they don't respect state borders. So are we just throwing money into a problem, and if other states aren't coming to the table, it's just going to be a moot point?
Look, in Victoria, they have let the deer numbers in eastern Victoria get absolutely out of control, and they're going to have to be managing that forever and the cost of that. But in western Victoria, west of Melbourne, eradication, just as it is in South Australia, is absolutely possible, and it's something that we are going to be working with farmers, with the municipal authorities there, to put on the agenda ahead of that Victorian election next year, because it needs to be a priority for all parties. And as you say, if South Australia does the right thing, and in Western Victoria they just continue to manage them like they have in Eastern Victoria, then South Australia forever is going to have to be stopping that wave of deer coming through. Now, it's much better to eradicate them in South Australia and then put that targeted effort into the border. It's sort of what happens with pigs, for example, in South Australia, where essentially there aren't many feral pigs at all. It looks like there's some populations in the Flinders Ranges establishing, which is concerning. But we need a combined effort, and ideally the front line of stopping deer expansion is essentially, if you imagine a line Melbourne up to Shepparton through central west New South Wales to about Rockhampton, and anything west of that, which includes the whole of South Australia, should be a deer eradication zone. Certainly it'll need the Victorian government to step up with their level of ambition.
Jack Gough, thank you very much for joining us as always on the Country Hour. Thanks for your time.
Always happy to chat.
Jack Gough, the CEO of the Invasive Species Council. Selena Green bringing you the Country Hour today. That's pretty much all I've got time for. Phil has sent me a text. I'll see if I can quickly get to it. Phil, his text says, apparently there's no examples of mining sites having been acceptably restored for farming in SA. He says there's a large area of farmland and natural roadside vegetation being destroyed near Pine Point on the York Peninsula at present. Hard to see that ever being returned to productive farmland, says Phil. This text, no name, and maybe something we can take a bit of a litmus test one day when we've got a bit more time. This text says, texter says, they've talked to a lot of farmers at field days and don't know any who support net zero. Thanks for your texts and for your company today. I will be back tomorrow at noon for more Country Hour, but right now it's coming up to 1 o'clock and time for the news.
Are you a long-time listener or maybe a first-time caller? The ABC Listen app makes it easy to join the conversation. Download the app for free and use the call text buttons to get in touch with your favourite radio programs live. Download the ABC Listen app today.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.